Live from Houston, Texas, the humidity capital of the world, it's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hey guys, welcome back to Money for Lunch. We're going to have just an excellent show. We have a new contributor joining us today, Kevin Heipel. Kevin Heipel is a bankruptcy debt relief expert, and I think that you're going to find his information timely and useful. Let me tell you a little bit about Kevin. Kevin is a best-selling author, an attorney who has been featured in USA Today, USA Today's Legal Elite, and has helped thousands of good people just like you get out of debt. In March, Kevin recently became a best-selling author on Amazon with his book, Get Off the Financial Roller Coaster. Today, we're going to be talking about your options for eliminating debt and getting a fresh financial and emotional start with our latest contributor, Kevin Heipel. Kevin, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. You know what? It's an amazing thing. You know, we're just kind of, you know, getting out of this recession, and some of us are still dealing with it, and you know, people are reeling with just tons of debt, and you know, they're upside down on their homes, and their 401's out of whack, and let me ask you this. Let me start off with this, real simple. When does someone know if they're having a debt problem?
Well, there's always a couple of ways, and I always start with the obvious ways. And the obvious ways that you're having a debt problem is that you're missing payments, you know, credit card, mortgage, car payments. You're getting collection calls. You're being sued by collectors. Your wages are being garnished. Your bank account's being garnished. So that's always the obvious signs of a debt problem. But sometimes people won't accept that. But if you do have those things going on, you just have to know that is a debt problem, because if you were paying the bills, nobody would be harassing you about it. Now, the not-so-obvious ones are, you know, when you get those credit card statements, and you know when you look in the right corner there, it shows you if you make your minimum payment, it's going to take you 20 years to pay it off. But if you triple the payment, you might be able to pay it off in 7 or 9 years. What we always look at is if you can't pay that debt off in 5 years, if you can't increase your payments to pay it off within 5 years, then that's a sign of a debt problem. And the reason why is because you can file a bankruptcy and pay all your debts off in a five-year period, and whatever you can't pay off, you can eliminate. So you have a legal right to get out of debt that you can't afford to pay within 5 years. So that's one thing we look at. The other thing we look at is the amount of unsecured debt that you have to your gross income. And if your unsecured debt, like a credit card, a student loan, a medical bill, a line of credit, is more than 20% of your gross income, you're going to struggle to repay that debt. And as it goes up, you're actually not going to be able to repay it at all. And these amount of debts can be pretty high quickly. If you think that if somebody's making $30,000 a year, if they have credit card debt more than $6,000, they're not going to be able to repay it. It's just too much debt to the income to repay, because you need money to pay for things like rent, car payments, gas, groceries, and insurance. It's okay to have those things. It's just when you have debt above 20%, the debt's now competing against those things. And so people either will cut back on the necessities of life, like groceries, in order to make a credit card payment, or eventually it gets so high that that's when they start missing the payments and they kind of realize, oh yeah, now I got the debt problem. But if they would have looked at it sooner, then they could have taken different steps to solve the problem.
Right. You know what? And I'm going to add my two cents in here. I think that from listening to what you just said, you know, if you're missing, you know, if you know you're getting a couple of calls and maybe you're late on payments, you know, that might be a debt problem. I think that if they're garnishing your wages and you're getting threats in the mail and possible lawsuit, demand letter type stuff, I would treat that as a debt emergency. You better take action.
Yeah. Yeah,
otherwise,
yeah,
your life is seriously going to go down the crapper.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Because once you get sued, in most states, the creditor is allowed to garnish your wages, and they can garnish up to 25% of your wages. So if you're in a position where you weren't able to pay the debt to where they're now they're suing you, you can't afford to lose 25% of your wages to pay the debt. And the problem is the debt that they sue you for is always going to be higher than the original amount because there's going to be interest that accumulated, there's going to be attorney fees that get added on, and so it always gets worse by the time you get to the point where you're being sued and garnished.
Right, and let's talk about this. You know, there's this emotional component that can really, really, cause a lot of issues too. In your book, you talk about the emotional challenges that people face when they are struggling with debt. In your opinion, with all your experience, what do you see as the biggest challenge they face?
It's fear. It's fear of not knowing what happens if you don't pay the debt. And then it changes to fear of what happens when what the collectors can do to you. Collection companies are notorious for using some underhanded tactics to get you emotionally upset so that you'll pay. And that will put somebody into fear. And so they worry, they're afraid of what happens if they don't comply with the collection companies. And then, you know, what's ironic is there's actually a big fear about the solutions out there. You know,
right.
There's a fear of what happens if I do credit counseling or what happens if I settle the debt or what's the fear of bankruptcy because they don't have all the information, but they're feeling the emotions of being in the debt and now the emotions of trying to get out of it. And there's all kinds of emotions that come in. There's the fear of failure. There's also the fear that, you know, that's not going to get better, but yet they have this fanciful hope that it is going to get better, that, oh, if I just win the lottery, this problem will go away. And so what happens is the emotions just kind of make them paralyzed. And as a result, what I find is that most people who have debt, they don't do anything about it for probably a couple of years when it first hits. And I think it just kind of takes a while to awaken from the slumber. And what I found with my clients, it's just the fear overtook them. And they became
right.
So afraid that basically they shut down and they did nothing.
Right. You know what? And fear has the ability to do that. It stops you in your tracks. And, you know, I think that the other fear that people deal with what are people going to say about me? Who's going to find out? If I file bankruptcy, if I get this debt counseling, if I go, you know, if I call Kevin Heipel, who's going to know? You know, my neighbor's going to look at me funny because they're going to know that I'm getting this help, which is, you know, first of all, not true. And second of all, really, who cares? You need help. Just get it. And, you know, back to, you know, what we started to talk about in the very beginning. You know, another symptom of a debt problem, if you're having a tough time sleeping, you know, if you're constantly worrying about it, that might be a debt problem. Kill it before it becomes a debt emergency. And you know, it's amazing to me, this thing that we as humans have, this fear where, you know, we're afraid that we can't pay our bills, but we're afraid of the solution. We're afraid of what other people are going to say. We're afraid that we're going to lose everything, but yet we don't do anything. We do nothing. And it's just amazing as humans how we are able to do this on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. Fear has competing interest, and then they all feel equally the same. So like what you said, you get to the point where like, well, they're all the same. There's nothing I can do, so I'm not going to do anything.
Right.
And eventually
right.
Something happens that will propel you to do it, whether you're talking to a friend who says, oh, have you ever looked at bankruptcy, or you're getting garnished, you're losing your home to foreclosure. You know, you see an ad on TV, and then all of a sudden the mind wakes up one day. It's like, oh, yeah, boy, we got to do something here. Because, you know, now it's gone beyond fear. Now it's about livelihood. It's about
right.
survival.
Let's talk about this real quick. What kind of solutions are available for someone who is struggling to pay their bills?
The most popular three solutions out there are credit counseling, debt settlement, and bankruptcy. And they all kind of work differently, and it really depends on somebody's income, assets, and type of debts. Like credit counseling is when you take all your credit cards and you get them on a repayment plan within 5 years, at a lower interest rate than what the current cards are. So if your only debt's credit cards and you got a pretty good income, it's a great solution for that. If you have other types of debts, then it's going to fall short. It's not going to solve it. Debt settlement is where you settle for pennies on the dollar. And you hear the stories. Well, you know, I was able to settle my $100,000 debt for $20,000. And that
right.
can certainly happen. And you can do that with a variety of debts. You can do it with credit cards. You can do it with medical bills. You can even do it with private student loans. The kicker is that you need to go into default on these debts. They need to be sold to a collection company because that's where the profit's made. Let's say you have a credit card at Chase, and it's a $50,000 card, and you haven't paid it. Chase will sell it to a collection company, and they might get $10,000 for it. And
right.
Chase will just take the $40,000 and write it off as a loss, is how they go about it. Well, now the collection company's in at $10,000. So for the collection company to make money, they just need to settle it for something above $10,000. And that's why you hear that, yeah, they'll take $15,000. And especially they'll take it quick because now they made a $5,000 profit within a week. I mean, that's a good rate of return. And so that's how collection companies look at it, and that's why you can settle the debts with them. The kicker is you need the $15,000 cash. You got to have the money. The collection company is not going to take payments over 5 years to get the $15,000. If they're going to take payments, they're going to want the entire $50,000, which they're entitled to do. And I think that's kind of one of those myths out there that people think, well, I'll settle it for $15,000 and I'll just make payments on it. And you can't do that. Another thing that people need to realize with debt settlement is you do pay a tax on what you settle. With my example, if you have the $50,000 debt, you settle it for $15,000, you are going to pay taxes on the $35,000.
Wow. So the $35,000 are looked at as what, income?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's looked as income, ordinary income. So you just add it to your line, and it gets taxed at ordinary personal income tax rates. So, you know,
wow.
If you're in a lower income bracket, that's maybe not such a bad thing. But if you're a high income earner, yeah, you know, that the amount of that debt to settle it has just gotten higher because you're going to have to pay taxes on it. And
well, this brings me to my next question. Then out of those scenarios, generally, what solution works the best for eliminating debt?
Well, that's what I was kind of alluding to earlier. It's always going to depend on the person's income, their assets, and the type of debts that they have. Because the other solution out there is bankruptcy, and that will get rid of most debts. It gets rid of everything except child support, alimony, and student loans. So if you don't have those debts, then bankruptcy can work well. But it depends on what kind of assets you have for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy allows you to protect many things. You can have equity in a home. You can have equity in cars. 100% of your retirement's protected if you file bankruptcy. But let's say you have a paid-off rental property. Well, if you file bankruptcy, you're going to lose that rental property. So in that situation, bankruptcy may not make sense, where you might get a loan on your rental property and use those proceeds to do debt settlement and settle the debt and pay the taxes. So that's why there's just never a one solution fits all, because everybody's situation is just going to vary. And so when people are out there struggling with debt, the best thing to do is, you know, look at attorneys who understand these different things. You know, if you're struggling with debt, don't call a debt settlement company hoping that they're going to provide the solution. What they're going to do is they're just going to give you debt settlement as a solution. And the same
right.
applies to attorneys. I mean, don't just call a bankruptcy attorney and say, well, yeah, I need to get out of the debt, because his or her solution is going to be bankruptcy. You know, call an attorney that knows about all of them, that's willing to do them all, and that way you can get just a straight advice and a clear answer on what is going to be the best solution for you.
Yeah, you know what, I love the fact that, you know, you're discussing all these three solutions, because it's interesting to me how this debt game works, for lack of better terms. You know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, if you owe this money to Chase, they may sell it for pennies on the dollar. Now you negotiate your deal with the collection agency. What's interesting about this, if anybody's ever dealt with, you know, bank or big creditors, you know, what boggles my mind, Kevin, is why wouldn't the bank just work out a deal with you in to begin with? You know, why wouldn't they just come and say, listen, you know, we're going to sell this for 10 cents on the dollar, but if you're willing to work a deal with me, I'll work out a deal with you for 15 cents on the dollar. I don't know why Chase and all these big creditors don't just do that with their own, you know, with their own people, their own debtors. It just doesn't make sense to me, but that is the way the game works. It goes from the, you know, from the original creditor to whoever buys the debt, and you know, and this thing can go on forever. And you mentioned something else that's so true, that you have these people that are really kind of scummy, for lack of better terms. They really are on the other side of collection laws and fair credit,
Fair Collection Act.
Thank you. The Fair Debt Collection Act. You know, they will use these mob-like tactics. They will lie to you. They will do all sorts of things to upset you, as you mentioned. And if you don't get off your butt and just get a consultation of some sort, talk to somebody and find out what your rights are, you're really going to pay the price, not only financially, but emotionally.
Oh, yeah. The emotional part's the worst thing about it. You know, and to your question earlier, why don't the banks settle? A couple of reasons why. One, the banks made money on you already. What I find with my clients who do end up filing bankruptcy is that whatever they bought on that credit card, they paid it off 2 to 3 times over. They just haven't paid off the balance because the interest rate's 16-20%. So they're chasing the compound interest rate. That's why they can't pay it off. But Chase has made money. I mean, whatever was bought has been paid for 2 to 3 times. And then the benefit to Chase is that once they do sell the debt off, now they can take a loss. And it's kind of a fake loss because they already made the money. So what they do is now they're able to take a loss to lower their taxable income. I mean, banks are profitable.
Right, yeah.
They know how.
If anybody knows about money.
Yeah, the bank always wins. They're like the casino. The house wins.
Right.
The bank wins. And so to them, you know, it's just a numbers game that works out to their advantage because they made the profit, and now they get to take this tax deduction. And, you know, they build it into their system. They know that 1% to 2% of credit cards are going to get wiped out through a bankruptcy, and they just add it as an expense like anything else that they would have, whether it's office supplies, computers, payrolls, you know, you name it.
Right, right. Hey, Kevin, we're out of time, but great information, great, great strategies there for people who are suffering from debt. Guys, if you have questions about your debt, you want to get a better night's sleep, you want to get off the financial roller coaster, check out ColoradoBankruptcyExperts.com, ColoradoBankruptcyExperts.com. Check out my friend Kevin Heiple. Kevin, thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet. Guys, we're off and running. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to talk with Watts Wacker right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, world-renowned futurist, author, social commentator, and provocateur, Watts Wacker. For 30 years, he has been a futurist or futurologist, as they say in Europe, first as the social research organization of Yankelevich, Skelly, and White, followed by being the ninth futurist at the think tank at Stanford University, SRI International. Previously both an entrepreneur and a corporate experience, author of 4 books and numerous articles and journal pieces. Watts Wacker, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, so walk me through this. How does one become a futurologist?
Well, I like to tell people, Bert, that you kind of announce to the world that you are, and then the world decides. But this has been a real discipline for going on 70 years. Perhaps the most, the first person ever to really have the handle or the sobriquet futurologist would have been Marshall McLuhan, who, you know, people remember for the great quote, "The medium is the message," although the quote really was, "The medium is the massage." And probably the most well-known person who does it today is still Alvin Toffler. Alvin Toffler wrote a seminal book, believe it or not, 40 years ago called Future Shock.
Yeah.
And it's when I was at Stanford, I was the ninth futurist that they had had, and that's almost 20 years ago that I was there. So it's something that has actually been around for a while, and there's true technique. You know, if your listeners are familiar with a man named John Nesbitt,
Sure.
used to use a technique that was called content analysis by dissecting out the content of the media. It was invented in the 1930s by MI6 to study what was going on in Germany. It was a lot easier when the only real media that you had to dissect was newspapers. SRI International co-invented a technique called scenarios planning, where you look at probable futures as opposed to just one outcome like you do when you do strategic planning.
Right.
Observational research, you know, I work as a practicing cowboy in Montana. I make tacos at a Taco Bell. I drive a bus for Avis at the Newark Airport. I've lived on the streets of Harlem several times as a homeless person. And it's all about being able to be treated in a way other than you normally would, and therefore have a very different understanding and kind of oblique angled experience of otherliness that expands the way you think.
Wow. Okay, so you now, when you do these experiments, I mean, like living on the streets,
mm-hmm.
how, you know, just... Do you like, okay, from this month to this month or from this time frame to this time frame, I'm going to live like this? I mean, do you plan it out?
Sometimes, you know, there are times I have done that for just my own primary research. There's been times I've been paid while I was doing that to study.
Gotcha.
For example, a major foundation wanted to study the ethnography of the relationships between mothers and children in poor urban areas, and that would give me a chance to sit and do that. I've also hired very famous writers to sit in an airport where I'd sit behind them, where people would come up and recognize them and want to talk to them, and I would just be eavesdropping on their conversations, things like that.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. You know, that's got to be a fun thing to do, though. Those kind of social experiments have to be just, I mean, a lot of fun. I mean, intriguing. They're like, as you mentioned, they open your mind to the way other people live. It's amazing.
Yes, it bakes my cake. I mean, you know, clearly that's a, you know, there's no distinct way to do this. I do
right.
like the fact that the Europeans use the word futurology, because the ology ending, whether it's biology, mythology, technology, is all about and its influence on society. So it's the study of the future and its influence on what you do today. And there's always a dominant organizing premise about the future. If you go back and you think of, you know, the Orwellian times when, you know, 1984 was written, in the phrase, and everybody in the first world knows the phrase Big Brother. And
right.
in particularly the Western democracies, we all read that book and looked at each other and said, there's no way we're going to let this happen. But truth be told, you don't have any privacy today. And so even though we organized our view of the future to ensure that Big Brother would never happen, it has happened. And if you use an Easy Pass, which we're what they call them here, or Sun Pass in Florida, or you use a cell phone, or you use an ATM machine, you don't have any privacy. And as we now know from the Snowden case, you know, language is analyzed for certain words to be able to detect, you know, there's certain things you just don't want to say into a telephone anymore.
That's right.
It only takes
right.
18 minutes to get from the New Haven FBI office to mine. So I tested that one out, too.
All right, so as a futurist, what is your vision of the future? Walk me through this.
Well, there, you know, every futurist seems to have had a great vision. You know, McLuhan's I referenced. You know, Toffler's was about the acceleration of the pace of change, the change in the pace of change. Nesbitt's was about the collision of technology and emotion. My vision in my first book. It's not like I'm supposed to have a vision every year or something like that. So I put my first book was my vision. Was
right.
That there's cycles of change that happen in 500-year increments, from Christ to the Nicene Creed to the Battle of Hastings, to the discovery of the New World to what we have today, and that we are living in a period that is absolutely positively and fundamentally identical to the Renaissance 500 years ago. And if you look at what happened at that time, you had the Gutenberg Bible and therefore the printing press, which was basically the Internet 1.0. You know, it was the unleashing of information like the world up to that time had never seen before.
Right.
You had the discovery of the New World, which really wasn't about the New World. It was about how the Portuguese and the Italians and the Dutch and the French and the British came over here and found this large quantity of something called gold and brought it back to the old world and had enough of it to create a new economic system based on markets, as opposed to up until that point it was based on barter. And the word Renaissance itself means renewal of thought and art, and we had
right.
a whole sea change in how we identified and looked at the social agenda. So when you have technology and you have economics and you have social descriptions and patterns and traditions and rituals all changing at the same time, those are those kinds of seminal moments in world history when that's happened. And so I basically argue that the information age is concluded, not begun. And I, in further writings, referred to it some years ago, well before 9/11, as the epic of uncertainty. And it's probably been the single most used word since, you know, actually not just since 9/11, but particularly since 2008.
Gotcha. Watts Walker, Wacker.
It's my real name, too, by the way. People, when you have competitors,
it's a great name because it's completely memorable, which you want that in a name or a brand, right? So it's a great name,
Watts Wacker, honest to God.
Yeah. I'm sure that you didn't get any kind of attention from the kids in elementary and high school with a name like that, huh?
Well, you couldn't make a joke I hadn't heard, if you know what I mean. So
Yes. Hey, listen, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back, talk more about the future, get into your book, and talk about storytelling. Guys, if you want to check out more about Watts Wacker, check him out at firstmatter.com. Watts, thank you so much for stopping by. I'd love to have you back.
Bert, I appreciate it. Take care.
All righty. Guys, we're off and running. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be speaking with Stephen Benedetto. No, it's Benedetto. Anyway, Stephen will correct me in a second. I just probably killed his name twice on the air. Anyway, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Guys, we're back talking with Stephen Benedetto, criminal defense attorney. What are your rights? We're going about to find out. Should you remain quiet? Let's find out. Stephen Benedetto graduated from law school in 2003. He immediately accepted a position working for the Arizona Supreme Court Justice, where he had an insider's look into the Bennett v. Napolitano. Golly, I'm having trouble with my English. Napolitano case, a separation of powers in the struggle between Arizona state legislation and the governor's office and the judiciary. For us who live in the great state of Arizona, probably remember this. Some of you guys might have caught a little bit of it on CNN and stuff like that. Anyway, he completed his one-year term and spent the next 6 years working for large multinational law firms. After tiring of representing Fortune 500 companies in complex litigation, Stephen founded Benedetto Torgensen in 2009 to represent real people, known as Ben Torg by his staff and clients. The firm represents Arizonans in claims against insurance companies for personal injury compensation and in cases against government for allegations that their clients have broken the law. Steve has focused his practice on defending people accused of crimes for the last 5 years and heads up Ben Torg's criminal defense practice group. Stephen, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
All right. Now, let me ask you this real quick, because I guarantee you most people don't know this, and I don't think I even know this, so I'm going to ask you. A police officer pulls me over, all right? And first of all, guys, I want to make this abundantly clear. Police officers have a tough job, so they all need to be respected and honored. So a police officer pulls me over and for a routine traffic stop. What am I under the law obligated to say or do with this guy? I mean, this girl pulls me over, says, let me see your driver's license and your registration. I comply with that. Beyond that, do I have to even talk to the police officer?
You do have to talk, but you're well advised to say kind of a minimum amount of information. For what it's worth, your disclaimer and your kind of suggestion to the audience that, you know, we'd be cooperative and compliant, it's a good one. We actually represent a number of police officers, and they really do a service to us, and they really do their best to do their job. But it's important to understand a fundamental difference between a traffic stop, which we've all been through. We've all been stopped for speeding, and a DUI investigation. You know, a traffic stop, we get pulled over. The officer's already seen us break the law. We've already been going, you know, 82 miles an hour in a 75-mile-an-hour zone. And at that point, you know, we're pretty much just begging for mercy. We're the kid that got our hand caught in the cookie jar and saying, oh, Mom, you know, please don't punish me. And in that situation, your absolute best scenario is to be cooperative, be polite, you know, tell the officer, I know I screwed up, and maybe he or she feels sorry for you and let you off with a warning. DUI investigation is a different animal. You get pulled over. Maybe the officer saw you speeding or saw you commit some kind of traffic violation, but a traffic violation, at least here in Arizona and in most states, is a civil violation. You pay a fine, maybe you get a couple points on your license, and it goes away. A DUI is a criminal violation. It's a criminal charge. It's a misdemeanor in Arizona. It could be a felony depending on certain situations that could arise during the course of the investigation, and it carries mandatory prison sentences, thousands of dollars in fines. It's a very, very difficult proceeding to go through, so you want to be very careful. And what you are obligated to do, you need to identify yourself to the officer. He asks you for your name, your license, your registration. You need to provide those documents. If the officer tells you you're under arrest or asks you to step out of the car so he can't arrest you, you're obligated to do that. Other than that, the Constitution says you have a right against self-incrimination, and the way that's been interpreted both by the Arizona Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court is that everything else the officer asks you is an investigation. You have the right to invoke your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which basically means, as a practical matter, you shouldn't be answering questions about where you're drinking, where you were coming from, what you were doing. What I always tell my clients and non-clients who just ask me, family members, friends, whenever this comes up, is just don't drink and drive. If you're going to drink and drive, as soon as you see the red lights, just assume. I mean, at that point, assume you've broken the law. Assume you are going to be taken to jail that night and charged with a crime. Do not try to talk your way out of it. Do not perform any field sobriety tests, which, you know, you'll see on TV once in a while, someone walking on the side of the road trying to do these balancing acts. We call them parlor tricks here in the industry. but, you know, they're very difficult to perform for anybody under any circumstances, let alone while you're being, you know, interrogated by a police officer on the side of the road. So essentially, you identify yourself. You're cooperative. Be polite. Recognize this is someone is just doing a very difficult job. Very frequently, they don't really even want to be pulling you over, but you did something that you shouldn't be doing. Just even if you think that you're probably not impaired, and very few people recognize they are, recognize that you screwed up just by driving after you drank. You're gonna get arrested and take your medicine. The result of that is that you give your attorney down the road the best possible chance to mitigate the damage, possibly get you a better plea offer, possibly avoid a DUI completely by not cooperating, not saying how much you drank, where you drank, admitting you drank at all.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you this, Stephen, because I know I can hear this across the nation. People always ask this of criminal defense attorneys. How do you do what you do? I mean, you got somebody like a George Zimmerman or a Jody Arias. How do you wake up in the morning and defend these people when they may be guilty?
Absolutely, and I think the question I hear most often goes even a step further and says, how do you represent these people that are guilty? There is kind of a rush to judge in our society,
right.
And very frequently it's right. I mean, we have these reptilian instincts to judge people that are dangerous and conclude, hey, this is a bad person, someone who committed a crime. But because we have those instincts, that's why we have the criminal justice system and the jury system, so that we can hear all the evidence before we judge. And so I think the question in some ways presupposes that my job as a criminal defense attorney is to get guilty clients off. And if that's how I viewed it, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. I wouldn't wake up in the morning. I'd find something else to do. I don't view that as my job. I think my job is to make sure, first, that my client actually is guilty, and that's the first thing we get to, is that they are guilty of breaking a law. Then what law are they really guilty of breaking? And the reason that's important is because in our current system, which is pretty broken, defendants are almost always overcharged. And they're overcharged because of this pressure, a budgetary pressure usually on prosecutors to not go to trial, to force a plea agreement, which is an agreement between the government and a defendant that I am guilty. And if they, like any negotiation, if you come in high, if you're trying to, or you come in low, you're trying to buy a car for $10,000, you offer six. Prosecutors
right.
do the same thing. They will try to get you to plead guilty to the lowest offense of a DUI, and they'll charge you with the highest offense. Or they'll try to get you to plead guilty of possession of marijuana for personal use. They'll charge you with possession for sale. So that's part of the problem with the system. And something that we try to actively safeguard against, figure out what our client actually is guilty of, and then ultimately, what is a fair punishment? And that's kind of the biggest safeguard and the biggest kind of civil service that I think we as criminal defense attorneys perform is making sure that there is some check on government power. And we live in a place where we have more people in prison in America right now than any other country in the world. By a long shot. Number two is Russia. They're about 30% behind us. I'm sure my grandfather, who fought in World War II, in part about concerns of communism, would be interested to hear that. And number three is Rwanda. And Rwanda is 50% behind us in terms of number of people in prison. So we put a lot of people in prison in this country. And most of my clients are first-time offenders. They've never done anything in the past. And they're shocked to see the amount of time they're looking at for something like marijuana possession or some kind of more serious drug possession for what they would think is petty theft, taking a $1,500 or so. That is a class 4 felony, class 5 felony in the state of Arizona. It's subject to mandatory prison time depending on the circumstances. We have clients all the time that look at the amount of time they could be looking at if they go to trial and lose and say, wow, this is crazy. And so,
hey,
Michael,
I'm sorry, my producer is giving me the signal here that I'm over time. But I'd love to bring you back and talk more about this, because I think that we as a society really are not aware of what exactly criminal defense attorneys do, and we also do not understand our own civil rights. Love to have you back.
Absolutely. I'd love to come back.
Great. Hey, guys, check out Stephen and his team at bentorg.com, BENTORG.com. Stephen Benedetto, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You bet. Guys, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be right back speaking with Jim Britt, the guy who gave Tony Robbins his first job, right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we're back. My next guest, author of 12 best-selling books, including Cracking the Rich Code, Cracking the Life Code, Rings of Truth, and The Power of Letting Go, among others. Presented to over 4,000 audiences, totaling 1 million people, served as success counselor to over 300 corporations worldwide, recently named as one of the top 20 success coaches in the world, presented with the Best of the Best award out of the top 100 contributors of all time to the direct selling industry, mentored and coached Anthony Robbins for his first 5 years in business. Jim Britt, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So, you know, let me ask you this. I mean, you have this just great, really rich history. How and why did you get started as an entrepreneur?
Well, it didn't start with a rich beginning. my first job was picking cotton in Oklahoma with my family from about age 6 to 12. And I learned early on that working hard and working long hours is not going to make you a lot of money. I think we made 2 cents a pound for picking cotton, and that doesn't weigh very much. And so I kind of graduated from there when I dropped out of high school into working in a gas station pumping gas, and again working 60 hours a week for a buck an hour. So again, I learned that working hard, working long hours is not going to make me a lot of money. And then I went into a factory and thought that, you know, I might be there the rest of my life. And then I got a tap on the shoulder one night and got introduced to a business, and my life changed. I kind of got the entrepreneurial bug, and I've had many, many businesses since. And I just could never go back to working. You know?
Gotcha.
I think
all
you
right,
work
so,
harder
so walk
and longer,
me through
but...
this. Just so we're clear, you got this tap on the shoulder and you were terminated. You got a pink slip, or was it when you say tapped on the shoulder, it was an inspiring moment that turned you into an entrepreneur.
Yeah. It was an inspiring moment. It was actually an invitation to come take a look at a business opportunity, and I was it was on my night off, and I refused to go a few times, and finally the young man that invited me, he said, hey, if you'll go with me, I'll buy the beer afterwards. And I'm going, okay, well, if you buy the beer, I'm going. And so I really went for that, but that was the night that my life changed. I mean, it was like a light went on in my head, and I'm going, whoa, I can do this, and I got the bug.
I love it. The first real, quote, light beer. Get it?
Yeah. That's good.
All right, so let's talk about this, because, I mean, here you are. You mentored Tony Robbins. You've written 12 best-selling books. You've had this outrageous career. You've spoken with millions of people. You've counseled hundreds of corporations. What's your take? What separates the highly successful from the rest?
For some people, I think highly successful, sometimes they kind of step into it. Maybe it's a best-selling book they had. Maybe it's by accident. Maybe they had like Tony had a big television infomercial that really brought him to the limelight, made him famous. And of course, he was very talented even with that. But I think what really separates successful entrepreneurs from all the rest is really the mental toughness, the mindset of an entrepreneur that they just tell themselves, you know, I can do it, and then they go figure out how.
Right.
They may not know going in how to do it, but they know it can be done, and they'll figure it out. So it's really a mindset, because, you know, mindset determines how you show up, and it also determines how others show up to support you. So I think that's probably first and foremost, because without that, you kind of, you know, you run into your first obstacle and you feel beaten and you kind of run the other direction. But a good entrepreneur will meet an obstacle and realize there's a way around it.
Right. You know, something that you said that I never thought of, and I never heard it articulated, is, you know, the mindset is responsible for how people show up to support you.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a neat twist on that. I've always, you know, you always hear about the mindset being, you know, how important the mindset is, but I never thought about the fact that the mindset really is the catalyst for how people will show up in your life to support you. I just think that's a neat little distinction there, and I wanted to point that out to anybody listening. I've not ever heard of that. Thank you.
Well, I think it shows up in two ways. One is when you have a certain mindset, you make a certain decision that creates that, and your view of your surroundings change as a result of that. You know, when you decide
sure.
to do something, you start to see everything differently, and you start to see people who may support you in your endeavor, you see them differently. But more than anything, You know, when you meet somebody new, you kind of get a feel for them. You know, that person's positive, that person's negative, they're upbeat. I want to be around them. I don't want to be around them. You know, that type of thing. And when somebody has a mindset that they're so determined to do a certain thing, people feel that. I mean, they really get a feel for that person. They want to be around them. They want to support them in some way. So
right,
it's a big factor.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Hey, let me ask you this. Okay, since we're talking about successful entrepreneurs, in your experience, what are a couple of other traits that successful entrepreneurs have?
You know, it's interesting. I recently interviewed 12 self-made mega millionaires, actually one billionaire. And as I'm listening to the interviews, I realized that all 12 of them had exactly the same traits in common, and they were all from different industries. All 12 were, and one of the traits really, which determines what we just talked about, the mindset, was their ability to make a decision and move forward. Because you know, a lot of people set goals to have things, but to me, a goal is an incremental step to take you where you want to go, and the decision is the foundation for that. And without the decision, a goal is nothing more than something you wrote down on a piece of paper that's probably not going to happen. But
right.
if you make a decision to have it, whether it's writing a book or having being wealthy or having a certain thing in your life or, you know, buying a new car, whatever it is, we decide to have certain things. And again, that determines your view of the world. So I think everything's got to be really that you accomplish has to be grounded in that decision that you've made. And I see successful entrepreneurs, they do that. And they're willing to change decisions too, but when they decide to have something, they may change how they go about getting it, but usually they go about getting it. And the second thing is that I know this is one for me, is that I think in today's world, you've got to be bold. I mean, you've got to step up and take center stage and do things that the average person is not willing to do. I mean, I think being bold is, you know, putting yourself out there. And I know one time I was decided I was going to start a chain of nutritional medical clinics, but I'd never done it before. But I knew I could make them go. And I met with
right.
a fellow that was going to supply me with all of my medical-type supplies that I and I didn't even know what they were at the time. I just had a list of it and sat down with him, and he said, so what are you going to do? And I told him my idea, and he said, oh, he said, good thing you had lunch with me. He says, I tried that, and he said, I did a grand total of $1,600 in business my first year. And I looked at him, and I said, well, obviously, you didn't know how to get people in the door, and I do. And
right.
I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And by the time I finished lunch, he said, do you want a partner? I'm willing to fund the whole thing for half of it.
Wow.
You know,
that's a great
–
Jim, we're out of time, but I'd love to do this. I know you're real busy, but I'd love to invite you back another time to talk about this. I think that what you're doing is very powerful, and it can help a lot of people, and I'd want to know and I think a lot of people would like to get to know you. How about coming back at another time?
Sure. I would love to do that. Absolutely.
Great. Guys, if you want to know more about Jim, check him out at JimBritt. That's BRITT.com. JimBritt.com. The Power of Letting Go is one of his top-selling books. Check it out. I think most of us need to let go. And Jim Britt, we'll have you back another time. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You bet. Guys, we're off and running. We're going to take no time for our next guest, Mr. Doug Eastland. As you guys know, Doug Eastland is one of our regular contributors. Doug Eastland is a top-producing realtor serving the Central Texas market and the owner of Eastland Systems, a real estate coaching and training company. Doug is also a best-selling author on real estate with his newly released book, The Ultimate Home Buyer's Guide. You can check out Doug and his team at eastlandsystems.com. And I want to say this because this is one of the things that impresses me about Doug and his team is that no matter where you're calling from, okay, call Doug and he will help you find somebody in your local area that can help you with real estate. That is customer service for somebody that will probably never do business with them, but gives you an idea of the quality of Doug and his team. Doug Eastland, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hey, Bert, it's great to be back.
All right. Hey, let's talk about this. Before a buyer starts the search for a new home, what's the first thing that you advise them to do?
Okay, well, let's start by saying that the one thing you shouldn't do first is go out and look for a bunch of houses first. I think the first thing you should do is, with wife or partner or whoever's buying the home, have a very clear picture of what you want in a house.
Interesting.
And everybody's got a good idea of what they would love to have. From there, let's talk about budget, a projected budget. You know, if you can only afford so much a month, at least have that in mind. Once you have those kind of ideas in your mind, then pick a realtor that has experience or specializes in the area that we just talked about that you're selecting and schedule a meeting in their office to sit down and talk about that. The best way to have a good real estate transaction is for everybody to be on the same page from day one. So the realtor's working on your behalf, knows what you want, and you know the expectations of each party. So everybody's working toward the same goal, which is to find the perfect house at the perfect price within the perfect time period. You cannot do that without first having some kind of a consultation or a meeting with the realtor. So schedule a realtor. Schedule a meeting with the realtor.
I love it. I love it. You know, I love the fact that you said, you know, figure out what you want in a house first. That makes so much sense because, you know, obviously whatever you start to envision or you think about is typically what you'll find, right? I mean, you draw these things into your existence. And I remember, you know, one of my favorite homes that we bought, and one of the reasons it was one of my favorite homes is because my wife and I sat down and we said, okay, we want this in the master bedroom. We want this for the kids. We want this. And we had this list of things, and we went and actually only visited three homes, and there was our perfect home, and that's the one we bought. Because it had everything. We knew exactly what we wanted. It made it so much easier.
Exactly right. When we get phone calls on a daily basis of, you know, can you come show me this house? Well, at that point, we have no idea if it's in the budget. What are you looking for? Is it still available? Can you qualify for it? All those things are going through the realtor's mind, and they probably should be going through the buyer's mind also. So when we get a call like that, it kind of tells me they really haven't had a consultation meeting. They're not working with a realtor who's kind of in their best interest, and they're just out driving around wasting $4 a gallon gas.
Well, let me ask you this, okay? You know, your opinion. What is the duty of a real estate agent after a home has been chosen – but before an offer is written? Walk me through this.
Okay. Well, let's play like, you know, I've got a buyer and we've been out and we found the perfect home and they really like it and they want to make an offer on the house. An agent can either do two things. They can go back to the office and write it up and present the offer and try to get it under contract for the buyer. Or I would prefer the realtor, myself included, to come back and do research on that exact house and see if the house is worth what they're asking for it and what it should sell for. So you try to take the emotion out of it a little bit. Just because you want the house doesn't mean it's a good deal. So let's us as realtors go back and do the homework and say, okay, the house should sell between this and this. Then we try to get the house in that bracket for you. So don't just get, don't jump out and just buy one just because they're asking this. Let's go back, do a little homework, do the research, see if we can get it for a price that's in the market.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You know what? And this is something that you've said a couple times being on the show, and it's so true. It's hard, I think, sometimes for buyers and even sellers to get this, and that is not to become emotional about the process because, you know, you said this before, and it's so true that, you know, what you need to get out of the house has no bearing on the price, and the buyers don't care why you're selling your house or why you're buying the house. You know, it's just a transaction, and you cannot get emotional about it, right?
Right, and that's the hardest part for us. It is an emotional thing, and we understand that. But at some point, logic has to come in there. You know, where people get in trouble is they go out and they buy a house, and they think it's a great deal, and they say, we're never moving, as an example.
Right.
And a year later, they need to move, and they've overpaid, and they're upside down. And we just hear it all the time. So at some point, we understand there's emotion, but try to bring the logic back into the transaction before you start signing things.
I love it. I love it. Let me ask you this, because I know that things have changed quite a bit in the buying process. Should a buyer present a pre-approval letter along with their offer? What's your take on this?
Well, absolutely they should, and I'll put myself, I'm the listing agent, and I'm going to get an offer from a buyer's agent, okay? I will not accept the offer unless I've got the pre-approval letter. So there's no sense in going through inspections and any negotiating, just anything to do with negotiating, if you don't know if they can even buy the house. So why waste the time of your seller if they can't do it? And if you're the realtor representing the buyer, why in the world would you ever want to write an offer on somebody that you know they can't buy it? So, one, I wouldn't write an offer if I didn't have the letter and was sure they could close on the house. And if, as a listing agent, I would not accept one without a pre-approval letter. And then all pre-approval letters have conditions. But at least they've checked the credit. They've checked money in the bank. They've checked things like that, some history. So I would never, on either side of a transaction, work with a buyer who didn't have one.
Gotcha. No, and I think it makes sense, especially, again, I love your example. Why waste anybody's time if the letter's not there? Now, let me ask you this. I hear that some buyers don't want to have their home inspected, quote, they want to save the money. Is that a good idea, even if it's a great price and the home is being sold as is? What's your take on this?
Well, it's a terrible idea to try to save the money, so I'll say it that way. If you're going to spend $100,000, $200,000, whatever it is, why in the world would you want to consider saving $250,000 trying to go cheap at the last minute? So, in the case of the houses are as is, that's not a problem. But at least reserve the right or write the contract with an option period that gives you the right to inspect the house. Yes, it's going to cost you a couple hundred, $200, $300 maybe in different markets, but give yourself an out. As is a great deal if you know what you're getting into. So I've sold several as is houses for people where they refuse to have it inspected, and they move into the house and they start doing some work, and all of a sudden they find things they didn't understand or expect. Well, it's because they tried to save $250. So that $250 will cost you thousands down the road most of the time. So it's a terrible idea. Always do the house. Have it inspected, not by your brother-in-law, not by an uncle, by a licensed home inspector in your state.
I love it. And what's the old saying? Penny wise, pound foolish, right?
Well, exactly right.
Hey, let me ask you this, because, again, I remember this happening all the time. Of course, this was before the market changed. In this market, can sellers still pay for some of the buyer's closing costs, or has that been completely wiped away? What's going on?
No, we do that every day, all day long. So,
It just
depends. On an FHA contract, you're going to have 3.5% of your own money in the transaction. Okay, that's the minimum. Now, on top of the 3.5%, as the example, there's still thousands of dollars of closing costs that need to be paid. Sellers can pay that on the buyer's behalf, okay? Now, what you have to be very careful about is if you're asking the seller to pay that on your behalf, you're probably rolling that into the loan or you're rolling that into a sales price. You've got to be very cautious that you don't roll anything up, which makes the value of the house way too high that if you ever had to sell it, you couldn't get out from under it. So a good example, if I'm going to offer a $200,000 house and I need $5,000 in seller concessions, We're basically offering $195. That's how a seller looks at it. They look at the net numbers. So could you buy for $5,000 less without that? Absolutely. But you have to decide what's most important to you, coming out of your pocket with $5,000 additional dollars or just having a lower sales price. But we do it all day long.
I love it. All right, let me ask you this. Final question. What are a few items a buyer should consider before deciding to buy a new home?
Well, like we talked when we just started talking today, the budget is probably the most important thing. You need to know what you are comfortable spending, not what you qualify for. Where people get in trouble is they qualify for a $300,000 house and they go out and they want to spend $300,000. Well, that's not always the best thing to do. So have a budget in mind that you're comfortable with that allows you to have a life on top of your house. You need to consider lifestyle. I mean, do you want to have a pool? Do you want to live near a golf course? Things like that. Whatever you're comfortable doing in your life, make sure the house allows that. Location factors in a lot. Do you want to be near work, near commuting highways, things like that? Something that a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to are your surrounding neighbors. I mean, you can have the nicest house in the world, but if you've got neighbors that aren't as nice around you, that affects your value. So if you're out shopping and you see a nice house, look around you. Drive around. Go back at different times of day and make sure you're comfortable with what's going on at night, in the morning, and just be very aware of your surroundings.
Right.
You
know, funny you should say this. I want to give you my own little personal example. We had a friend of ours who bought a home, and it's a really nice house. They went through the inspection process. They did everything except for what you just suggested, which is go there, you know, during, you know, different parts of the day. They never, ever realized, and the real estate agent never told them that their house was right up against a train track.
Yikes.
Could you imagine? And, you know, it's just like, you know, they were like freaked out. You know, here's their first night in their home. They're asleep, and that train comes in there. I guess what they told me is that they have several trains in the middle of the night, one like around 1 o'clock and one like at 3 o'clock. I mean, right there tells you, you know, you really need to hire somebody that's got your best interest, in their heart or in their mind. And definitely some real estate agents, you know, they are only going off the information they know. So it's very, very wise to do as you suggest and go there, spend the night if you can. Talk to the neighbors, find out what's good about the neighborhood, what's not good about the neighborhood, because, you know, if they would have talked to just one person, that one person would have said, we have this massive train that comes here twice in the middle of the night. You know, anyway, needless to say, they are selling their house. They lived in it for a year, and now they're hoping to sell it. And so far, no takers. No,
yeah,
no
good luck
takers
on that
at
one.
All.
I would bet the next person sees the train track.
That's right. It's a tough one. Oh, Doug, we're out of time, but always good to have you on the show. Great information. Guys, check out Doug and his team at EastlandSystems.com. That's EASTLAND Systems.com. Doug Eastland, best-selling author, real estate expert. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Bert, I'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.
You bet.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.